Today's Teisho will be on case 37 in the Book of Serenity. Guishan's Active Consciousness. Introduction. Driving away the plowman's ox, pulling its nose around, taking away the hungry man's food, holding his throat tight. Is there anyone who could administer the poison? Case. Guishan asked Yangshan, if someone suddenly said, all sentient beings just have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on, how would you prove it in experience? Yangshan said, if a monk comes, I call him, hey you. If the monk turns his head, I say, what is it? If he hesitates, I say, not only is there active consciousness, boundless and unclear, they have no fundamental to rely on. Guishan said, good. Verse. One call and he turns his head. Do you know the self or not? Vaguely, like the moon through ivy, a crescent at that. The child of riches, as soon as he falls on the boundless road of destitution, has such sorrow. I want to thank everybody for coming here today. As we were doing Kinhin, I noticed many people in line, and I was just so happy that you were able to come here today and practice. We weren't really planning to have quite this large a crowd. Usually, we don't get quite this many people on a Saturday. I was worried that we would not be able to get everybody into this very small room, but we seem to be doing okay. So I hope you're not too uncomfortable. I hope it hasn't been too uncomfortable for you this morning. But it's really wonderful when people can get together like this and practice. So thank you very much for coming. I wonder, though, why you came. You know, I have to ask myself, why did you come here? And if you ask yourself the same question, the results might be interesting. Why did you come here? It's possible that you came because of the potluck lunch, yes, and the party. It's possible you came because you haven't been sitting with our group for a while and you wanted to get back with our group. If you were sitting by yourself and you asked yourself, why did I come here? You might find it difficult to provide an answer. Years ago, I remember seeing a movie in Seattle on Zen practitioners, I went with my second teacher, Kangan Webb. As I recall, I believe I went with him. It was a film shown in an art cinema house. In Seattle, we have a lot of movie houses that show, you know, sort of French movies or Japanese movies, imported movies, and sort of artistic films. And they had a couple of films on Zen Buddhism, as a matter of fact. And one of them was a documentary on this temple in Japan. And they took us through the day of the monks in the temple. And I was watching it, and I didn't know much about Japanese temples, not having trained in one. And basically the monks got up, and they all went into the washroom. And they washed their faces very, very slowly. It was for me, it was surprising. They had basins of water, and basins that looked like of hot water. And they put their faces down to the basin, and they put their hands in the hot water, and they splashed it on their face. And the steam came up off their skin. And I interpreted this as meaning that it was cold outside, but the water was hot. And they washed their faces very carefully, very slowly. And as I watched it, I thought, oh, those monks are being so mindful. You know, they're being so mindful. They don't just splash water on their face. Every gesture is conscious and careful. Yeah. Anyway, Webb later told me that the room where they were washing wasn't heated, and the water wasn't hot water. It was ice water. They basically just punch a hole in the lake and get the water from there. And so these monks were washing their face on a very cold day in a heatless bathroom with ice water. So this explains, you know, the hesitation, right? You know, reaching down into the ice water, splashing like a little bit on their face. And the steam coming up wasn't steam from the water. It was the surface of their skin was hotter than the water, you know. And anyway, that was a surprise. Other elements of the film were like that too. Apparently, the zendo, the Zen hall in most temples in Japan, are not heated. So you know, if it's 30 degrees outside, it's 30 degrees in the meditation hall. And this was made clear because the monks did have extra clothes on and or heavy robes, and you could see them shivering. And at one point the camera followed them, and they were going down the hallway, and the doorway opened into a room off the hallway. And inside was the Roshi, the old teacher. And he looked like he was about 80 years old. And he was sitting next to a heater, drinking tea. And the expression on the monks was heartbreaking. They were all looking, they were freezing. And they're looking in that warm room, right? And just thinking, oh, you know, if only, you know. It's just like they looked heartbroken, like, oh, that room looks so warm. And then they had to move down the hall. They had to go on with cleaning the zendo and cleaning the hallways. And a little later in the film, they interviewed a number of the monks. And the interviewer said to like three monks, he said, why are you here? And you know, it amazed me that none of them could offer an answer. You know, they were just literally mute. Why are you here? You know, they didn't say, I'm searching for enlightenment, or I came here because I broke up with my girlfriend and I'm trying to forget. You know, or they didn't come and say, everything is one, you know, they didn't say something like that. They were utterly stymied by the question, right? They just were mute. At the time, I just thought, that's the strangest thing, you know, because I got interested in Zen by reading lots of books, actually. Long before I ran into Genki Roshi, I had read a fair number of books on Zen by Liu Kuan Yew and D.T. Suzuki. And so my head was full of ideas about what Zen would be like. But these monks had nothing to say. I just think that's very interesting. I thought at the time that they were just probably rather stupid. I'm ashamed to say that's what I thought. What happens to people who do Zen training for a long time is that they begin to get in contact with a different part of the mind. And this is quite important. Different part of the mind. Now, when you start meditating, if you come to a beginner's meditation class, you know, if you come here anyway, I'll explain how to get started. I'll say, you know, sit on the cushion in the proper way, breathe through your hara, your dantian, squeeze the breath out and watch the breath. And when you sit on the cushion and you do this, at first you might find that your mind is just buzzing with thoughts, buzzing with thoughts. So, you know, you're sitting on the cushion, you're trying to watch your breath, and you're thinking, you know, why did he say that to me anyway? You know, he never treats me the right way. Or you're thinking, I've got to get an A on that chemistry test or I'll never get into med school. Or you're thinking, is that pizza place open after this? You know, so. If you keep practicing meditation, you keep sitting, there'll come a moment when you stop thinking that way. It won't happen like this forever. But there'll be moments when you're sitting when you stop thinking that way. You stop planning or trying to arrange things or projecting into the future or reflecting on the past. And you enter a kind of consciousness which is more present in the moment. Yeah? So all of a sudden it becomes possible to watch your breath. And the breath goes out, and then it's gone. The breath goes out, and then it's gone. The breath goes out. You think, this is okay. I'm in the moment. Very nice. And probably as soon as you think that, you start thinking, but I wonder if the pizza place is open. So you start thinking again, you start planning and so on, dreaming, think, you know. But little moments arise on the cushion in which your attention is focused more or less on the moment without the thoughts preoccupying you so much that you can't be attentive. And this happens if you practice regularly more and more. And it's usually accompanied by a good feeling. You usually feel better, calmer, a little happier. And a little stronger sense of stability and so on. Now this is a deeper, this state of mind in which you're just present with the moment is, at least from the Zen standpoint, a deeper state of mind than the mind that's planning the future or reflecting on the past. You know, because you're actually present in the moment in this second state. You're actually, the breath is coming and it's going and you're present in the actual moment, yeah? And this is really quite a wonderful experience. After that, what's likely to happen to you is that you won't be able to maintain that concentration, or you won't be able to stay at that level of the mind if you keep practicing. Because what's going to happen to you is you go down to another level of consciousness. Which is like this storehouse. It's like your personal memory and a collective memory, cultural memory. So you sit on the cushion, you watch your breath, And at first you have these thoughts about, I've got to get an A on the chemistry test and so on. Then you're watching the breath and you're in the moment. And then all of a sudden, you start remembering things that happened to you 25 years ago, or maybe in your case, 15 years ago. And it's just like memories start popping up from your past. And they may not make much sense. You may not know why they're popping up, right? But they come up. And many people at this stage in their training think that they're going backward. They think that they're slipping into unfocused attention again. And they can get very frustrated, and some people even quit at this stage in their practice because they just get discouraged. But you're not going backward if this happens to you. You're going to a deeper level of the mind. And at this level of the mind, you begin to encounter what we could call your karma. This is like your mental habits, the information you've stored, all the memories you've laid down over a lifetime. And it doesn't come out in a coherent story. It doesn't come out in a rational way. It just comes out in little pieces. Many years ago, I was coming back from a sesshin, a meditation retreat, with a guy named Gordon. I think his name was Gordon. He had the unlikely name of Gordon Goody Koontz. That was really his name. And his father was a theologian, apparently a very respected theologian, and he had met Genki Roshi, our teacher, Genki Takabayashi, and had begun to practice with our group. And he had gone to Sesshin, and he'd come back very disappointed, because he said, all during this Sesshin, I couldn't get this song out of my head. And it was the theme from a television show, which probably nobody here has ever seen. There used to be a show on TV called Maverick, starring James Garner. And he played a romantic, handsome, roguish gambler out west. And this was a very popular show, and they had a little song about it had a little ditty at the beginning of the show each time about Maverick, New Orleans, living on Jackson, Queens, da 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 da. So Gordon had, like everybody, made considerable sacrifices to come to Sesshin. And he was hoping it would go like this, You sit on the cushion day one, your mind becomes focused. Day two, more focused. Day three, enlightenment. Day four, teacher says, you've achieved it, wonderful. And so on. But it didn't work that way for Gordon. What happened to him was that around day two, it was Maverick, New Orleans. And every time he sat on the cushion, this was driving him crazy, right? And this can happen to you, right? I'm sure if you've been practicing for a while, this is something like this. It's maybe not for 5 days straight, but for some time. And it seems disappointing. But this is part of a natural process. This is really an important part of meditation practice. This part of the mind where the karma is stored is called the alaya vijnana, the storehouse mind. And working through the storehouse mind is really, in many ways, the central aspect of meditation practice. Because all of us have quite a storehouse of memories. And it's very important to work through that storehouse in order to wake up. One of the most interesting things that you learn in Zen practice is how difficult it really can be to see the world or encounter the world just as it is, just as it actually is. You know, it's ordinary people think that they're in the world just as it is all the time, and that there's no problem experiencing reality. And, you know, that seems believable until you begin to observe human beings carefully. The other day I was reading about how polar bears are may be put on the endangered species list. And I guess you know why that might be happening. There hasn't been a lot of development, real estate development, in the Arctic yet. But the Arctic is heating up quite a bit. And the ice sheets on which polar bears live are melting away. And this was in the New York Times. And my wife was reading an article the other day about how a piece of the Antarctic ice sheet had broken off. It was a piece slightly bigger than Manhattan. And it had gone floating down to Tierra del Fuego. And they said this could be caused by global warming. So we all sort of know that this may be happening. And yet we don't really do anything to change it. And I think that's not unimportant. You know, human beings live in a world which is about 25% real and about 75% imaginary. And this is why, actually, it's quite difficult to experience the world just as it is. And you see this if you just observe human life, right? I mean, so much of what we do is counterproductive or destructive or wasteful. And if you ask people consciously, they'll tell you, oh, yes, I know that. So for example, something like 75% of Americans are quite concerned about the environment. Many Americans are very well educated. They get up and read the New York Times. They see the article on the polar bears and think, I've got to do something, right? As I do, you know? And then they think, gotta get to work, right? And they go to work. And you go to lunch, and you talk to your friends, and you have a big report due, and the polar bears are gone, right? Now this is interesting, because so much of our lives work like this, right? So much of our lives work like this, where we're in sort of a kind of a fantasy land, about 75% fantasy land. And every once in a while, we get in contact with reality. This happened to a friend of mine recently. He's going through a divorce, and a difficult divorce, because I have a number of friends, actually, who are going through divorces right now. And for him, this is a difficult divorce because he said to me, I was so shocked by this divorce. He is, I think it would be fair to say, a true workaholic. You know, he's somebody who is very respected in his field, and he is everywhere you look. So he just won a national award for a book he wrote, and he's very... very skillful administrator, very skillful academic administrator and leader. If you pick up certain journals in his field, there's his name. If he hasn't written the article, he's referred to in the footnotes. I know he's been going through a very painful time because we talk quite often and. And he said, I was just stunned by this. You know, basically it was one of these stories where his partner, his spouse, came to him and said, you know, you really have been neglecting me for years, and I've been terribly unhappy. And you know, I used to love you very much, but I'm so unhappy. I don't want to live with you anymore. And my friend, who is a very nice guy, was stunned by this. And it was like, how could this have happened? And one of the things you often hear from people in this situation is, I just didn't know. And I must say that this person has been my friend for more than 20 years, and he's smarter than I will ever be. But he is not any more observant of reality than most people, I would say. You know, in other words, he's probably been coming home for 20 years, and his partner in life has probably been pretty unhappy. You know, and somehow he didn't want to see it. It's just like with the polar bears. You know, somehow we see it, but we don't see it. It's like we humans live in a world of, and I think this is much more profoundly true than people normally realize, you know. But we humans live in a world which is, as I say, about 75% dream, you know. When we have painful experiences, when we have difficulties, we start manufacturing dreams. It's like we're like like an oyster. You know, an oyster produces a shell, and it produces the pearls by secreting whatever it is, calcium carbonate or something. You know, when it encounters an irritation, it secretes calcium carbonate. And my theory is, and it probably sounds a little crazy, but my theory is that when humans encounter irritation, they secrete dreams. They secrete ideas and images and theories of the universe, yeah, and ideologies and politics and so on. And what they're trying to do is to protect themselves from something that's threatening. And I think we've all experienced this, you know. When I was in graduate school, sometimes I would be sitting in a classroom, just lost. The other graduate students in the classroom were often so much smarter than I was. You know, they spoke many languages. They knew everything about the history of philosophy. And every once in a while, I could just go away and climb a mountain. I'd be hiking up in the mountains, you know, in my mind. And I'd come back and listen to somebody drone on, and then I'd be hiking, you know. And it sort of made it bearable, yeah? If you study you know, people who have had traumatic experiences too, very often they respond to the trauma by creating a kind of fantasy, you know, fantasy world. I'm not here, this is not happening to me, I'm somewhere else. And sometimes it's even the case that what they remember is like a false memory, because they don't want to remember what really happened, they remember something they wanted to have happen. And I think this is very common. So what happens to human beings is that they get very caught, in my opinion, in like a world of dream. We're secreting these dreams all the time. And, you know, one day we come home and there's a note on the refrigerator that says, "Dear, I'm leaving you," you know? And you think, what? Leaving me? Why? Right? You know, maybe it was because you were spending 70 hours a week at the office. You know, maybe it was something like that. Or, I could give you so many examples of this. You know, my brother and my father never got along. And my brother had a lot of personal problems because my father would just not accept him for what he was, or even see him for what he was. My father couldn't look at my brother and see him for what he was, and it drove my brother crazy, you know. And like many teenagers, he would act out. You know, he would got drunk with some of his friends and created a little scandal on the base where we lived. You know, he shoplifted once and so on and got into trouble. And all of this is way, I think, kids have a way of trying to say to their parents, like, see me, see me. But my father just couldn't get past his own dreams and see his own son, you know. So I think we all do this. And the problem is that we secrete these dreams and these ideas and these visions and so on. And it allows us to be tremendously creative. It's the reason we are artists or writers or scientists, whatever. And it's wonderful. But at some point, we're just not in touch with reality anymore. It becomes very difficult to say what's real and what's not. And it becomes very difficult to say why we live the way we live, you know. If you ask yourself, why am I doing what I'm doing? It might be very difficult for you to answer that question. So Zen is, if you really want to understand what Zen is all about, it's about encountering the real. Right? And it means encountering the real in the world, but also encountering what's real in yourself. What's real in yourself. And this is very hard to do because we have all these dreams in the way of all these ideas of who we might be or who we could be. So Zen practice is really encountering the real. And my theory, my idea is it's very difficult for humans to encounter the real, or it seems to be. So a lot of Zen practice is working through the storehouse mind. A lot of Zen practice involves sitting on the cushion and trying to just be aware of something so simple, like the breath, right? You know, breath is so simple. It's just here and it's gone. It's here and it's gone. And it's difficult at first to get through all of the dream, all of the ideas, and just be with the breath. And for a little while, we're able to be with the breath, but then, you know, there's this whole issue of our mental habits, our deeper experiences, life, past life experiences, that make it extremely difficult to be in the moment and to act naturally. So, you know, it takes a while, if you're doing Zen practice, to work through the storehouse mind, this collective unconscious. Little by little, you start to experience life in a different way. It doesn't happen overnight, and it doesn't happen once and for all. But you start experiencing life in a different way. It's this experience of contact, a connection, that's absolutely thrilling, absolutely energizing. And I'm sure if you've been practicing for a while, it's happened to you. You know, you come in to sit, and you sit on the cushion, and you struggle and struggle and struggle, and then the bell rings, and it's over. Right? You have some tea, and go home, and go to sleep. Next time, same thing. Next time, same thing. But then, all of a sudden, you know, you're sitting on the cushion, and something happens to you. And something happens. You know, you feel like your face or your hands are disappearing. Or maybe you feel like everything disappears. I remember practicing at a Zen center near Seattle. And it was one of these places where the teacher just kept it icy cold all the time. And I didn't like being there because it was cold all the time. And I came in and sat down on the cushion and tried to get away from the cold. And I had the most amazing experience because it was literally like I fell into a big black hole. I'm not kidding. I mean, if you haven't been there, just take my word for it. It was like everything in the world absolutely, totally disappeared. And it was so serene. It was so amazing. And when I got off the cushion, at first I thought, well, what was that all about? You know, and then I sort of forgot it. But, a little later, I was sitting, and I went back to that place. And I didn't have any words to describe it. It's not part of my my cultural world. You know, growing up in the West, I had no idea what this was. But the odd thing was that, you know, when I went to that place where absolutely everything disappeared, where it's like falling into a black hole and so on, I felt so alive. I felt so alive. And at some point, I went to my teacher and I said, you know, I've been going, this experience, this strange thing has been happening. And he basically said, oh, this is a mu. This is mu xin, wu xin. So he gave it a word. And I realized I maybe had gotten in contact with something. And that was a wonderful moment for me. But this happens to you in your practice, you know. People come to talk to me about things that happened to them on the cushion, and sometimes it's very subtle, and sometimes it's very dramatic, and often we don't have language for it, because it really is, I would say, fundamental reality. Guishan asked Yangshan, if somebody suddenly said all sentient beings just have active consciousness, boundless and unclear, with no fundamental to rely on, how would you prove it in experience? Yangshan said, if a monk comes, I call him. I say, hey you. If the monk turns his head, I say, what is it? If he hesitates, I say, not only is their active consciousness boundless and unclear, they have no fundamental to rely on. This is one of these crazy Zen koans that probably make no sense. But if you keep practicing Zen long enough, you begin to experience this natural self, what we call a true nature, natural self, real world natural self, and it's the self you encounter when you are in this state of on reflecting spontaneous presence in the moment. And it's difficult for us to get there. But every once in a while, we actually find ourselves simply resting calmly in the moment. And we notice something. And this is usually accompanied by this rush of energy, or this feeling of, sometimes we have experiences where we feel more alive, and we don't know why, we just feel more alive. So for me, I often get that if I'm not sitting, when I'm hiking. You know, if I go up into the mountains and hike, I might not have ever gone where I'm going at that time before, but you know, I might turn a corner and suddenly see something, and it's just like being lifted out of myself. It's not an intellectual experience, but it's this sense of making contact, this feeling of making contact. I went to the Metropolitan Museum about a week ago to look at some calligraphy, Chinese calligraphy. I looked at this beautiful calligraphy by a man who's, what was his name? I think his name was Jin Feng. And when I looked at it, I felt like I was looking at the face of a mountain. It was like all thought ceased. And I had this tremendous sense of being connected to what I was looking at. And then there was this rush of energy. And I went out of there feeling so alive, so alive. This is really different kind of life. You know, this is a different way of living. But beyond thought, beyond ideas, beyond concepts, humans really do have the capacity to encounter reality, the world, in a thoughtless, wordless way. And as I said, it takes a lot of work. A lot of Zen practices is getting to those moments where that's possible, because we have all of this baggage, all of this karmic, all of these mental habits that stand in the way of that. But every once in a while, when we experience reality in this way, we feel more alive. And this is the Zen life, you know, to go from these, from one of these moments to another one of these moments to another one of these moments, on and on and on. And I can only tell you that you know, even though it takes a lot of work, it's been it's the most wonderful path, in my opinion. It's like sitting can be like a great Zen master described it as like the face of eternal youth. Because every time you encounter the world as it actually is, even if it's something you don't particularly like, you know, it's like being born all over again. This is the Zen life. So everybody here has come to practice today. And I hope you had a wonderful sit, and maybe you had one of these experiences today. Maybe you didn't, but I hope you'll keep walking this beautiful path, and I hope you will. Well, everybody has had these kinds of experiences in the past. You know, it may not be have anything to do with Zen, but something brought you here. It might have been personal tragedy, but it was more likely a moment in your life when you realized yourself that there's something beyond this life of the mind, something beyond ideas. The things we value most in life, I really believe, are impossible to explain or justify. You know, I've been married for 30 years, and I can't tell you why I married my wife. And I'm sure she can't tell you why she married me. But for some reason, I just felt so alive in her presence. And if you have been married, or if you are married, you know that any kind of relationship like that is difficult. You're constantly working through your own fears and attachments and illusions. But you know, the other day we were going into the city, and it was just, I felt so alive, so wonderful. And being with her was such a pleasure, such a real joy. And I think all the things that mean the most to us are beyond or deeper than this level of, this layer of ideas. And it may be something in your life has brought you, something like that in your life has brought you here. So I want to thank you for coming. We now have a new year. And if this is the first time you've come here, this is your opportunity to maybe make a New Year's resolution. People don't always keep their New Year's resolutions, but you know, maybe you want to encounter your true nature. Maybe this is a time to think about pursuing that experience. One call and he turns his head. Do you know the self or not? Vaguely, like the moon through ivy, a crescent at that. The child of riches, as soon as he falls on the boundless road of destitution, has such sorrow. We spend our whole lives struggling to find something that's accessible to us every moment. We think it might be all kinds of things. Money, respect. We look for happiness everywhere. But really, your liberation is right here in this moment. And if you just keep practicing, you will find it.